The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has reconvened. The Honorable Robert J.
Thank
Steigman presiding.
Mr. Bailiff. The case this afternoon is 4-24-0782, People versus Derek G. Edmondson. Counsel for the appellant, state your name, please, sir.
Dan O'Brien.
And counsel for the appellee.
First name Allison Page, last name Brooks for the people.
Thank you, counsel. And then, Mr. O'Brien, behalf of the defendant, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Dan O'Brien from the Appellate Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant, Derek Edmondson. There's no question in this case that at the time Derek pled guilty and all through sentencing, he was under the impression that the guilty plea that he had negotiated made him eligible for probation. He believed this because both his attorney and the court told him this multiple times. The state doesn't challenge this. Derek's guilty plea was not knowing and voluntary. He received erroneous advice from his counsel in addition to the erroneous 402 admonishments. But for this, he would not have pled guilty. The only issue is whether Derek must be allowed to withdraw his guilty plea that he entered based on this universal misunderstanding of the law. Because a guilty plea operates as a waiver of important rights, due process requires that it be knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. Generally, a trial court's misrepresentation of the sentencing range invalidates a guilty plea. An improper admonishment does not automatically require reversal. As the Supreme Court explained in Davis, whether reversal is required depends on whether real justice has been denied or whether the defendant has been prejudiced by the inadequate admonishment. The Davis court also explained unambiguously what it meant by that prejudice. The court noted that the defendant's allegation that he wouldn't have pled guilty but for the inadequate or the erroneous admonishment. And stated, due to this misapprehension, he did not attempt to negotiate a lesser term of incarceration and forewent the opportunity to go to trial where he may have been acquitted. Because of this prejudicial effect, the trial court's decision should be reversed. In other
Counsel,
words,
good with you and work reverse this conviction and further proceedings. What would that look like back before the trial court?
I'm sorry, do you ask if we reverse this
Yes.
and oh yeah, I believe that that it should be reversed and Derek should be allowed to withdraw his guilty plea and just put back in the position that he was before that point.
Would the state similarly be put back in a position it was in before defendant
Absolutely.
pleaded guilty?
Absolutely.
Pardon?
Absolutely.
If my understanding is correct, the defendant is supposed to be paroled or is due parole in February of 27. So that's talking about 3 years from now, plus that. In the event we were to reverse and the case went back for trial, what's the most the defendant might face if the state said, we don't want to be fooling around with this guy anymore. The hell with him. We're going to go full bore and we're going to pursue all of the various cases against him to get the maximum sentence we could get. What would that potential sentence be, counsel?
I believe hypothetically the absolute maximum could be 28 years, but realistically 14 years is the most that that Derek would likely be facing.
Why is that?
Because I believe it's clear from the record that the state was going to have an extremely difficult time establishing the case against his son, who wrote a letter on his behalf, who who has since joined the army and I think that, and again, and I think that that's very much a part of what Derek was thinking at the time too, is that he was well aware that his son did not want to prosecute this case, and he was really only looking at the case against his father.
Well, in domestic violence cases, and this is one of those, experience shows that attitudes of witnesses change over time, often to be more forgiving, sometimes to be less. And but if the state went full bore, The defendant faces 28 years in prison, does he not? As a possibility?
He could potentially legally face up to 28 years.
Okay. So that would be seven times the sentence he's now received in this case.
Correct.
So here's my question. Does the record show that the defendant understands the risk he's taking if this court grants his motion to withdraw or reverses the denial of his motion to withdraw his guilty plea? And let me be more specific. We know about North Carolina versus Pierce that says when the person's defendant's been convicted and the state can't, if the state has appealed, they can't go out and punish him for his efforts to have an appeal taken. There might be in the ethers some notion that perhaps this defendant even has that, I pleaded guilty and I was sentenced to 4 years in prison. And if that motion to withdraw is granted, I can't get more than 4 years and on a rebound. Now, I don't know that the record, I don't know if the defendant thinks that. Nothing in the record shows it. But he's not a cum laude graduate of law school, and maybe he is under that impression. My point is the defendant aware of the significant risk he faces by pursuing this motion to withdraw, and if he, in quotes, wins, unquote, on appeal?
The defendant is aware of the circumstances in which his sentence could be potentially increased on remand.
What in the record shows that?
I'm sorry, I just that's from my conversations with the defendant. I thought you were asking simply whether he was aware of that.
Well, I am, but my concern is this. I can see now we reverse, case goes back. There's been no hearing in front of a court. There's been no admonition to the defendant. The trial court never said at the hearing on the motion to withdraw guilty plea, which, by the way, going back to prehistoric times when I was still a trial judge, I would do and say, by the way, Mr. Edson, I understand you're making this motion, but here's what could happen. I want you to talk it over with your counsel. I want to make it clear that you understand this risk. And if you do, so be it, that I'll address this motion on the merits. But I don't want there to be any misunderstanding, such as we grant the motion to withdraw, we reverse, motion withdrawal granted, state goes back and gets a mere 14 years on trials. And I know so comes as a shock to Mr. O'Brien, but says, my lawyer from OSAD was ineffective. He didn't tell me about all this stuff. I understand he told the appellate court, we talked about it, but I didn't know. And I was never given that admonition. I didn't know that I was facing several times more than the sentence I already had. What about that, Mr. O'Brien?
Again, all I can really say to that is that we have discussed that he's aware of the of all the potential circumstances, and I'm not
Well,
sure
how
what else.
about this as a thought? Before, if we're going to reverse, why don't we reverse and remand with special directions to the trial court that the trial court, before accepting the defendant's withdrawal of his guilty plea, pursuing his motion, that the trial court on remand will have to, in fact, make the record I just spoke about to make sure that the defendant's adherence to his motion to withdraw guilty plea is the same kind of understandingly and knowing election, similar to Rule 402, before a defendant guilty plea will be accepted, because the stakes here are pretty great. What about that?
I think that would be a fantastic idea, and I think that's probably how I should have answered the question. I think that that would be appropriate.
Because I have no doubt what you're telling us is absolutely accurate, but that's your recollection of a conversation that's not on the record and no admonitions from the judge. So it occurs to me that this is a potential problem, and if we're going to reverse, that would be the better way to do it.
I agree with you.
Okay, on the merits, what about the fact that, as the state claims, he didn't really suffer any prejudice here because we're talking about the one maximum sentence. Well, he said it was probationable, but he wasn't going to get probation. But also, the trial judge says, gee, I would have given him more if I understood it wasn't probationable. What about that?
Correct. I understand that, and that's the issue, of course, in Rhodes. And but the thing here is that where you have this particular confluence of circumstances, the issue is that justice was denied, and he was prejudiced because due process was violated. It's not about the result of the proceedings. It's not about the sentencing and what happened and what could have happened. The prejudice was essentially completed the second that he gave up his rights. He gave up his right to have a jury trial, and he gave up his right to attempt to negotiate a better sentence, specifically based on his belief and the admonishment that he could get probation. And in a case like this is what, and it's clear from the record throughout, this is what Derek was looking for. This is what they negotiated for. This isn't just some minor difference in the way that he was admonished. He believed that if he pled guilty, he could get probation, when in fact, from the second that he pled guilty, it was guaranteed that he was going to prison. So again, that's where the prejudice lies, that he surrendered his rights because of this admonishment. It doesn't lie in what happened hearing.
You know, counsel, this reminds me, this court sometime some years back wrote an opinion suggesting that trial courts should utilize the pre-flight checklist, one of the things being to make sure everyone's on the same page, namely, if this case went to trial, what's the potential sentence range, and what is this a probationable offense? Is extended term eligible or not? And it's pretty shocking to think that the McLean County Court and the prosecutors didn't bother apparently to confirm what exactly the penalties are here, nor defense attorney. Everyone was under the same misimpression, apparently. Is that what happened?
Yeah, that it looks like that's exactly what happened. And unfortunately, they actually did appear to essentially go through that pre-flight checklist and
And
simply.
they still messed up.
Yes, exactly.
So they were all on the same page. They were just all wrong.
They were, exactly. I mean, it appears, and again, the state too. The state, I think I have it here somewhere, the state's comment on this was the negotiated terms of the agreement were so that defense counsel could request probation. So, I mean, and not only that, but they added this fifth count. They specifically added an additional count because they believed it was probationable. And that's the one that he ended up pleading to. So, again, I think Derek swore in his affidavit that if he had known he was not eligible for probation, he wouldn't have pled guilty. His actions support this. He filed the notice that he was going to rely on self-defense prior to trial, and this is a claim that he raised again in his pro se motion to reconsider sentence. We don't have to take his word for it that's what this is. This was fleshed out in the pre-Krankel hearing before the new counsel was appointed and discovered the error. The trial attorney explained that there were lengthy negotiations that led to the agreement so that Derek could have a shot at probation, and that Derek understood the efficacy of pleading to a probationable count versus going to trial and risking conviction on multiple non-probationable counts. And also the videos of the incident that Derek believed bore out his self-defense claim. Counsel disagreed with this. Counsel didn't think that this would have led to an acquittal, but he acknowledged that Derek saw it otherwise. Derek believed that those videos showed that he was defending himself in relation to that count. And that's key because, again, the question there is whether Derek pled guilty because of this misapprehension of the law. So, and again, and as I mentioned just a minute ago, even the state drew that same causal connection that this plea was specifically negotiated so that they could request probation. And again, and this is the exact situation in Davis. The one arguably significant difference between this is that in Davis, the mistake was discovered prior to sentencing. So the court didn't consider and reject probation as it did here. But that's when you get into People v. Kidd, which was also discussed in the opening brief, there where he believed that he could receive something less than a life sentence, but in fact, he could only receive either life or the death penalty. There was a sentencing hearing. The court considered and rejected prison of any kind and sentenced him to death. And that didn't matter. And so, I mean, the prison there is analogous to probation here. The court said the decision to plead guilty to a criminal accusation is a grave personal judgment, and an accused should not be allowed to enter such a plea unless he has a full comprehension of the possible consequences of so pleading. He didn't because he didn't realize he was facing a mandatory life sentence. Derek here didn't realize, or didn't because he didn't realize he was facing a mandatory prison sentence. The issue is that he was told and believed that he could get probation if he pled guilty. But as I said, in fact, he was simply guaranteeing that he was going to prison, exactly what he was trying to avoid. So the guilty plea wasn't knowing and voluntarily entered. It was induced by the erroneous understanding of the law that was perpetuated by the court's admonishments. Thus, he was prejudiced and real justice was denied, and the case should be reversed and remanded. And as you said, Justice Steigman with instructions. The same result is required because of the ineffective assistance of counsel he received. And again, there, the error itself is beyond debate, that the first prong of Strickland is clearly satisfied. The question is whether he's prejudiced. And that's somewhat similar analysis to the previous argument. Is there a reasonable probability that, but for the erroneous advice, he would have gone to trial? So there's a sort of a reasonability component that isn't present in the other contexts. But even in this context, he's not obligated to prove that he would have won a trial or even that he could have won a trial, only that under all the circumstances, it would have been rational for him to have gone to trial. There's little question, as we've discussed some already, that in fact, Derek would have rejected any plea offer that didn't include a shot at probation. He made that clear. But that decision also would have been rational under the circumstances, particularly because, as I've noted, his goal here was to avoid prison. It's clear from the record how significant that was to Derek. Thus, if he'd known he could not be sentenced to probation, it would have been reasonable to take a chance to trial because it would have been his only shot at avoiding prison. So that's true, even if he only had a remote chance of winning a trial. But Derek doesn't concede that it was remote. Derek thought he had a legitimate chance to win a trial. He believed the videos of the incident bore him out. Whether or not they would have is a matter of conjecture. They're not on the record. They weren't. They were never even played in the trial court. All we have is defense counsel's inherently biased explanation of what he believes it shows in the context of explaining why he didn't use the videos. We also believe, again, this was mentioned earlier, we also know that Derek had the support of his other alleged sons, would have also gone into the expectation that he had a reasonable chance of winning a trial. So based on the circumstances present here, there is a reasonable probability that Derek would have gone to trial, but for counsel's erroneous advice. That, again, is a sufficient basis to require remand. But because the 402 admonishments and the counsel's advice were both erroneous, Derek was prejudiced by giving up substantial rights for an illusory outcome, and the case should be reversed and remanded with instructions. If there's no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Brooks, on behalf of the people, you may make your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. Rule 402 requires substantial compliance, which was found in the Rhodes case, despite the erroneous admonition with respect to the special type of probation involved in Rhodes. And here it wasn't a special type of probation, but it was similar in a sense it was probation. and the defendant was in fact not eligible for probation on aggravated battery of a senior citizen, and so therefore the admonishment was incorrect. But that doesn't mean that there was a lack of substantial compliance, or the issue that defendant raises here is the under the Davis case, whether there was prejudice or a denial of real justice. So under
counsel, given the issue in this case, isn't this about the strongest fact pattern under which it could be presented? Meaning that the defendant said he thought he was going to have a shot at probation. His attorney said that. The prosecutor said that. The judge said that. And the agreement itself was structured to allow a probationable count. This seems like the very strongest possible fact pattern to say he was bargaining for exactly that.
Except that, as in the Rhodes case here, the trial court did in fact consider the request for probation and denied it for a reason other than the fact that the offense was not statutorily probationable.
Right, but isn't the injury to him not dependent on what the judge decides? It's when he gave up his rights, it was part of a bargain. And it turned out the bargain at that time offered him something that it wasn't going to deliver, which is the chance for probation. He didn't know what the judge was going to rule at that point, but what he did know is he's giving up his rights to a trial and that he would have the chance to argue for probation. And as it turned out, the latter was untrue, and it was misstated to him as being true.
But he, in fact, got the opportunity to argue for probation at his sentencing hearing because the judge did consider it and rejected it for reasons other than the fact that it was statutorily ineligible for probation. The other thing was the incentive for the plea was the 8-year cap on the prosecutor's recommendation when, and also the dismissal of other charges, which could have been discretionary.
He definitely got other things out of that deal. And I think Judge Steigman's questions would raise some real concerns about, is that the right decision to take those chances? But it is his decision, and he made it with information that was inaccurate.
That's true that he and everyone else were under a mistaken impression, but actually the error worked out in his favor in the sense that in terms of the sentencing implication, as the judge made on the record, that it would have considered a higher term of sentence under the cap of 8 years if the judge had known that this was not a probationable offense. So the defendant actually received a lesser sentence.
Right.
Because.
But you can't just follow one timeline, because here's another timeline. The judge says this is not probationable. And he says, well, then I'm not going to plead. And he goes to trial and he's acquitted. So we can't just pick this timeline and say that's the outcome of the error. If it had not existed, the outcome could have been different.
It's most not likely the situation he would have been acquitted because as the mention has been record, the defense attorney who described the existence of a video, which shows two things, the defendant angrily approaching almost to a chest bump of the 85-year-old victim, which is the type of thing that would instigate contact. So you cannot rely on the
right,
victim.
But we're talking about his right to have his guilt or innocence tried. That's what he gave up. So he may have lost, he may have prevailed, but the point is that's what he gave up based on information that was incorrect.
Yes, he did waive his right to trial, but he received other incentives than just the opportunity to be considered for probation.
But not all the incentives that were promised to him.
Well, the descriptions under Rule 402 about the possible penalties is not part of the incentive to the incentive for him to plead guilty was the cap on the prosecutor's recommendation at 8 years and the dismissal of other charges. That was the official consideration provided for his plea of guilty, of which he received.
Right. But the record is really strong at showing what else went into that decision. And it had to do with the probationable offense. The deal was structured to make that possible.
Well, it's true that was the reason why they attempted to submit a fifth charge and dismiss the others. But My point is under 402, substantial compliance is required, and the defendant, of course, is admonished with respect to the potential penalties that he would have faced without the guilty plea. And of course, if it's here, it's potential discretionary consecutive sentences of 14 years up to 28.
So how is this different from Davis? Because in both cases, it was sort of the bottom end of the range that the defendant was misinformed about at the time he made the plea. Why isn't this like Davis?
Because under the Rhodes case, like this
Well,
case,
Rhodes doesn't get to reverse Davis.
I understand that, but the judge is actually considering a request for probation. So the defendant wants that opportunity to request probation, and the judge entertains that, and then only says because of the seriousness of the conduct, imprisonment is necessary for the protection of the public, therefore a probation sentence would not be allowed. And under that basis, he's in fact received the opportunity to apply for probation, which the judge considered and rejected for other reasons, and then receives a
Except it's
lesser
kind of
prison.
play acting because it could never happen, right? It's a performance that talks about whether he'd get probation, but the truth is he could never get probation.
That's true that he was not statutory eligible for probation.
I have a
But
question,
had
counsel.
he known that, because we're talking about his decision when he pled, had he known that, doesn't the records strongly support that he wouldn't have pled guilty?
The record, the state's view of the record is that it would not have been rational for the defendant to reject the plea agreement under the circumstances. And I had more to say about the video, the descriptions of the video in the record to further that point. But I believe Justice Steigman had a question.
Yeah, my question, counsel, is as opposed to a lot of these cases where question is motion to withdraw a guilty plea and the issue comes up about was the defendant really serious and what was he seeking and his claimed explanation for why he wanted to withdraw his guilty plea sometimes doesn't look to make a lot of sense. In this case, isn't defendant's affidavit consistent with essentially the defendant's posture and supported by, as Justice Torres points out, the circumstances of what happened here? He says, wait a minute, I wouldn't have pled guilty if I thought this was a non-probationable offense. I was hoping for a probation. That's what I talked about with my lawyer. I now understand everyone was mistaken and telling me it was probationable, so I want my guilty plea back and I'll take my chances. And under the circumstances here, isn't that affidavit something that we should give weight to?
Yes, this court could give way to it, but also the record shows the description of the video shows the defendant has no realistic possibility of being acquitted on his claim of self-defense. Because after the point with the chest bump and then the victim pushes the defendant, the description of the video given by the defense attorney in the record says that the defendant had struck the 85-year-old victim while the 85-year-old victim was on the ground. So there's nothing in self-defense that would make it objectively reasonable because the self-defense here is a complete exoneration of the charge. So therefore it must be objectively reasonable. If the defendant thinks that he was defending himself, that's not good enough. It has to be objectively reasonable
Right,
that is.
but we're both attorneys. We could counsel our client. This doesn't make any sense. You really should take the plea. But we also know it's his choice. And if he makes it based on information that's inaccurate, why isn't his choice what matters here? And remember, the judge would have never had a chance to sentence him unless he had pled guilty, right? And he'd have to have been convicted otherwise. But we keep looking to the judge's subsequent actions to somehow cure the fact that he was given bad information at the time of the plea. And the point is, the sentencing judge would have had no case to sentence had there been no plea. And he's made a pretty good case there would have been no plea from him, wise or otherwise, if he had had the right information.
Except the state's position is that there's no prejudice because the error actually works out in the defendant's favor because he necessarily would have been convicted if the video showed him striking an 85-year-old victim who was on the ground. There's no way any jury or trial court sitting as trier of fact would have found a reasonable doubt or found exoneration on the basis of a video showing the defendant striking an 85-year-old victim, a defendant striking an 85-year-old victim who was on the ground, who was posing no threat at that time. And that's why self-defense cannot be the defendant's refuge here. So therefore, he has no realistic defense to the charge. The fact that he received less of a sentence as a result of the judge's misunderstanding of the potential penalties means that error worked in his favor, which is the opposite of what prejudice would be.
Well, it sure sounds like we're deciding whether he needed his constitutional right to a trial. We think it wouldn't be helpful to him. And it doesn't seem like that's our call.
Well, the standard under Davis is if this is a prejudice or a denial of real justice, that would be up to this court to decide. That the defendant who says that he wants to plead guilty only to get a chance for probation, a statutorily unauthorized sentence, is somehow lost his thereby lost his right to have his guilt or innocence determined at a trial, whether it be a video that would show that he would almost certainly be convicted of that, of these offenses. I'm not sure. I'm not really needing to talk about the other victim. Just the one case, if he's convicted of that with no plea agreement, he would have gotten higher with the plea agreement if the judge had known, under the 8-year cap, if the judge had known this offense was not probationable. How much higher would the judge gone if there had been, in fact, no plea agreement and no cap?
What if there had been no plea, right? I mean, he may not have had a defendant to sentence. The whole point is we're brokering this after the fact and saying, well, it really didn't harm you to waive your rights in return for something that you didn't get. But that just seems like not what we should be doing. He wanted to plead, to make his case for probation, or he wasn't going to plead. He wasn't going to get that case, but he did plead. That doesn't sound like the benefit of the bargain to me.
Well, the benefit of the bargain is the trial court considering the request for probation. If the fact it was denied because probation would deprecate the seriousness of his conduct or imprisonment was necessary to protect the public, then the defendant got it what he bargained for. He got the cap.
But we only know that after the fact. At the time he entered his plea, if he had been told, you will not get to argue for probation, where would we be? Possibly at a conviction, possibly not.
Right,
Counsel, I have a question. I want to ask you about my musings that I asked Mr. O'Brien about, namely, in the event we were to think that this case should be reversed because of all the factors that Justice Daugherty has been talking about, what about sending it back? And by the way, I've never seen or heard of anything like this, but doesn't mean it wouldn't be the right thing to do. Sending it back and saying to the trial court, we are vacating and remanding, not reversing yet. Well, I'm not sure why we phrase it. In any event, telling the trial court, look, Judge, here's the situation. We think that your denial of the motion to withdraw on this record at this point, as it appeared to us, was erroneous, and we're sending it back to you to grant the motion. However, before doing that, we want to make sure, not unlike a Rule 402 admonition, that the defendant fully understands the risks he's taking. Namely, as you heard my discussion, if the state decides they want to go after this guy because they don't like him or for any reason, it's their discretion, to pursue trials and convictions, he faces as much as up to 28 years. The state is able to do that. And to point out that the court is asking him to reaffirm that this is what he wants to do after making it clear on the record it's a knowing and intelligent election by him of the motion to withdraw a guilty plea, thereby setting aside the 4-year prison sentence he is now serving to be paroled in less than 2 years, or whatever it is. I've not seen one of something like this before. And telling the court, by the way, that if the defendant decides and consults with his, he ought to have counsel to advise him at the trial level, obviously, to appoint counsel or hire counsel to consult with the defendant. That if the defendant decides that, I don't want to take that risk, so I'm going to withdraw my motion to withdraw my guilty plea, then you can grant that and forget about it, as opposed to giving him a chance to reconsider. And then if he grants it, if he stays with it and the court then vacates the guilty plea pursuant to our direction that they have to do so, everyone's in the same posture as they were beforehand, and the state can go after them for maximum 28 years and try them as long as they wish, however they wish. What about all that? I know you're an experienced appellate lawyer, and I'm just like with Mr. O'Brien, I'm just running it by you for the first time. Any thoughts?
Well, Your Honor, it would give the defendant an opportunity to make a decision if he wants to keep the deal, despite the fact that he was misadmonished. That type of remand order would be to grant him an opportunity to withdraw his plea, not like ordering the plea withdrawn, if that were the remedy, that then he would still have that opportunity to decide whether he wanted that relief. After all, having perhaps new advice from other counsel, being able to think about it. And reconsider like how much time he has left on his current term. Does he really want to face this other the likelihood of conviction and potentially more serious sentencing? So I do trust counsel's representations that he has in fact been informed this, but hearing it from a judge and having another opportunity to reconsider could be helpful, I guess, under the circumstances. The state does feel like the defendant here is not going to it's not going to turn out, quote, winning this appeal is not going to turn out well for him. But he's obviously insisting on getting this relief. So that would at least give
Good
him
way
an
to put
opportunity.
it. Putting the appeal wouldn't turn out so well, is your position. And you may be right.
But I mean there have been other cases where the defense have appealed and then it goes back and then they end up in a much worse spot. So this is would not be the first time that would have ever happened to anybody.
That's the be careful what you ask for rule.
Yes, Your Honor. And so the one problem here, though, of course, is that the video itself is not in the record. So
The what? I believe
I
it
do,
is.
it is in the record.
You said the one problem was what, counsel?
The video is, I don't believe, is in the record. So if it was in the record, then this court could at least make the determination objectively whether a self-defense claim would be,
Is that even necessary? I mean, in Davis, they just looked at what he gave up and how he was misinformed. They didn't look to whether he'd prevail at trial. They just said that was his decision.
Well, that would be to the 402. I was also mostly discussing his claim under of ineffective assistance of counsel. It'd have to be rational for him to reject a plea agreement under the circumstances. And the circumstances would include the nature of the evidence against him and whether he has any legitimate defense. And here, self-defense would not be a legitimate defense if he's striking an 85-year-old victim on the grounds. So that's why the state's position would be that he would not be entitled to reversal under his claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. So obviously, it's up to this court to decide under these circumstances, despite the Rose case or under the Davis case, whether this constitutes prejudice or denial of real justice. So I've said, I think, all I can on those points. I didn't entertain any of the questions. Otherwise, I would ask this court to affirm.
Okay, well,
Thank
thank
you,
you,
Your Honor.
counsel. Mr. O'Brien, any rebuttal, sir?
I just one comment or observation I'd like to make. In reference to the second argument, the ineffective assistance of counsel, and the question of whether it would have been reasonable or rational under the circumstances to reject the plea and go to trial. I think it's important to remember, as was just noted, that none of us have seen this video. We're relying on the representations of the defense attorney, who is defending himself for why he didn't rely on the video. And as a point of fact, the victim in this case is 62 years old. And that figure of 85 comes from, ironically enough, the defense attorney, who I'm not sure where he came up with it from. But again, it was in his vehemence to explain why he thought that Derek couldn't win at trial. In the exhibits, it starts at page E30. There's the medical records of the victim. And so every page for 50 pages, it says what his birthday is. And it's in 1958, and he's 62 or 63 years old. So, I mean, that just really points to, again, that we don't know. We're relying on somebody else's clearly biased, somebody with a very specific known agenda describing what he thinks the evidence is. So, even as in regards to that ineffective assistance of counsel claim, we don't know that it would have been that irrational.
Okay. Well, thank you, counsel. And I want to mention this is an unusual, interesting case. And I'm sure I speak for my colleagues when I say that I thought you, Mr. O'Brien, and you, Ms. Brooks, both did a very nice job in responding to the court's questions and laying out your respective positions. So I thank you for that. And
Thank you.
the court will take this matter under advisement, stand in recess, and issue a written decision in due course.